My guest is Professor David Crook. Professor Crook is an Englishman who has been living in communist China for 20 years. He is a journalist, and he has been teaching English at the Foreign Language Institute at the University of Beijing. He's here in the United States on a speaking tour. Professor, it's rare that we have a chance to talk with someone who spends so much time in China. My first question, whose side are you on politically? The USA or Mao Zedong?
Does it have to be that lineup?
No, we'll go any way you like, but I thought that would be a good way to start.
Well, you see, I was in China in 1938 and taught out there for some years before the revolution. I saw something of old China, and I've seen something of new China, and I'm on the side of new China.
Mm-hmm. Well, must I then assume, through the logical sequence of the way my particular mind works, that if you're on the side of new China, then you are in political opposition to the United States position?
Well, what do you call the United States position? You mean the administration's position, or the American people's position, or your position, or somebody else's position?
Well, my position is that of the government of the United States, because
oh, no,
the government
I'm not
of the...
on that side.
Hold it,
no,
hold
no.
it, Professor. This is my classroom. The government's position is of necessity to the rest of the world, the position of the people of the United States, because the people of the United States are the government. I must exclude the placard-carrying kooks who would be much better off doing something constructive than walking up and down with, you know, one of these pieces of cardboard. So is the point then made?
Why? No, the point's not made.
All right, make it.
You say that the position of the administration is the position of the American people. Now, it may be of interest to you to know how a Chinese would look at that these days. He makes a very sharp distinction between the American administration and the American people.
Does he make the same distinction with his own government?
No, they have what they call a people's government in China.
In other words, he says that the people of the United States have one position, the government of the United States have another position, but in China, thinking and being there, and thinking as the Chinaman, that his position is the same as the Chinese government's.
Well, I can see the way I'll have to do it this evening. I'll have to butt in if I'm to get a word in edgewise. Now, the Chinese say that the Mao Zedong has put this thing rather simple, in such simple terms that, as Tom Lehrer says, only a child can understand it. He says the American government is bad, the American people are good. So that's the general sort of approach you get in China.
Does Mao make everything quite as simple as this? I mean, these blanket statements that explain everything?
He can explain a good deal to people who are capable of understanding.
Mm-hmm. Then may I quote to you one of Chairman Mao's bits of philosophy, which is very, very basic, very simple. Quote, all political power grows out of the barrel of a gun.
Right.
Go along with that?
Well, don't you go along with that in Vietnam?
No.
What is it you're suggesting? That you're getting political power in Vietnam
out
of the power of a pamphlet or something?
No, let me put it to you this way, Professor. I'm suggesting to you that you, being a man who knows the situation there...
Right.
...who has lived there for many, many years, who still is a British subject, which puzzles me. We'll get back to this. How is it that you are able to retain your British citizenship?
Well, the British are a bit more broad-minded about these things than the American administration.
I see. It's all right for them to have you live 20 years over there and teach and retain your British citizenship.
Yes, they never had any Senator McCarthy's over there.
Mm-hmm.
Not yet.
I see. Do you enjoy Mao's form of government?
As I said before, I saw old China and I've seen new China. You see, in old China, when I was teaching in Shanghai in a mission university, the street cleaning department used to go around the streets in the winter mornings and pick up the corpses of the people who'd frozen to death overnight. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, they don't do that anymore. The people have enough to eat. I enjoy that very much.
How much do they have to eat over there?
They have more to eat than they've ever had in the whole of China's history.
Enough to really subsist.
Well, there's 700 million of them. There's a certain amount of subsistence there, you know.
Yes, that's true. How are the other economic factors for the common man over there?
Better than they've ever been in Chinese history, I would say.
Mm-hmm. They have two dresses, or an equivalent of 2 yards of cotton cloth a year. Uh-huh. Up until this time, I suppose everyone went around nude.
You have a whole stock full of suppositions in there. Now,
I haven't suppositions. I have as many facts as
Look,
you have.
Who is it that spent 20 years in China, you or me? Let me get a word in here.
Oh, by all means, get
all
a word
right.
in.
Now, if you go around the museums in China, they have some rather interesting exhibits. And one of the exhibits they have very often is the clothing that was worn by the people in the past. And you'll often find put on exhibition in these museums a piece of clothing handed down from 3 or 4 generations, and the same with a piece of bedding. Now, if you've lived in a society like that, and today you're getting 2 or 3 suits a year, you're doing very well.
Mm-hmm. Cheers.
Cheers.
One bar of soap a month, is that an improvement? Or is that not a fact?
That's not a fact.
Oh, how many bars of soap a month do they get now?
I've never gone round counting.
Nice.
But they have all the soap they need. But let me tell you something about that. When I first went out to a village in North China in 1947, my wife and I were gathering material for a book, and the kids used to come into our room and watch us typing in the middle of the winter. Their hands were black, and I asked why they didn't wash them. And they looked at me as if I were rather uninformed and said, well, you see, it's cold in the winter. If you wash your hands, they get chapped and it's painful. So I suggested, well, you might put something on them. I wasn't suggesting Cole's cream or anything. But I said, why not a bit of pork fat or something like that? That's cheap enough. But the fact of the matter was that if those peasants in those days were to get a bit of meat to eat once a year to celebrate the Chinese Lunar New Year's festival, they were doing very well. And of course, I was way off the beam when I said, use a bit of pork fat to rub on your hands. Now they've got pork fat to put in their stomachs and soap to wash their hands with.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't got the precise number of cakes of soap, and I can't give you a commercial for the brand of soap.
All right,
either.
Can you tell me this, Professor? What does the average worker, if there is such a thing, let's say an apprentice worker,
mm-hmm.
earn?
Now, of course, I know what you want me to do. You want me to give you a figure in terms of Chinese currency and say, my God, how can anybody live on that? But that, of course, would be nonsensical. You've got to think in terms of purchasing power, real wages. Now, take an ordinary skilled worker in a factory. He gets what would amount to a small sum in American currency. I myself get what is in China rather a high salary, but a very small sum in American currency. The question is what you've got to spend it on. Rents are very low, food is very cheap, clothing is cheap, cinema, entertainment, and so on is cheap. So the fact that a worker in China today gets, skilled worker would get, say, 80 yuan a month, he's doing pretty well. Also, there is not a very wide wage span in China. You might get a skilled worker earning 80 yuan a month and the manager of the factory getting 120, not several times as much. This the Chinese consider very important. They don't want to develop a privileged bureaucratic class of people who are cut off.
What do they want to develop there, Professor?
They want to develop a prosperous, modern, independent, socialist country.
And can one do this without the intellectual?
You're suggesting that they are trying to, but that happens...
No, not. I'm suggesting that they're cracking down very, very hard on 5 million intellectuals that don't particularly adhere to Mao's thinking.
I'm afraid you're uninformed again.
Now excuse me, Professor.
Let me answer your question.
Excuse me, Professor. Excuse me.
You ask me a question, I'll answer it.
I know you will, but you'll also wait a moment. I'm perfectly aware
of what you are prepared to say,
well,
I will
that's
not...
that's rather a waste of time asking, then, isn't it?
In a sense, yes. Very definitely. However, I will not be taken in by all of the stock answers. When you simply say to me that I have lived there for 20 years, I know. You know one thing, but I might suggest, Professor, that perhaps the things you know and the things that we wish to impart are not necessarily coincidental.
You speak of imparting. I suppose eventually in this program you're going to ask me something about freedom of speech in China.
Oh,
now,
no.
Now, if you would give me a little freedom of speech here, I will answer your question about the intellectuals.
All right. Tell me about the intellectuals, Professor.
Right. The Chinese are anxious to educate and cultivate a new class of intellectuals who come from among the working people. I've been given to understand in the few weeks since I've been in this country that there are millions of young people over here who go to school and emerge from school without being able to read and write. Now, the Chinese are very intent on having the people who in the old days were deprived of an education get a chance to go to high school and to university. That is not what I call cracking down on the intellectuals. That's what I call opening things up to produce a whole nation of intellectuals.
My turn?
Well, don't make it too long.
No. Very good, Professor. What you're really saying is that the young people are being taught the party line, exactly what Mao wants them to learn, and the old intellectuals, those who do not agree with Mao, are being cracked down on. Isn't that more or less what you're saying?
I'll tell you what I'm saying.
All right.
Some people are being cracked down on. The people who are being cracked down on in China are the ones who would like to restore Chinese society to the old type of society which existed, which I mentioned before, when they used to pick up the corpses off the street in Shanghai in the morning, when the peasants used to pay 60% and 70% of their crop in rent to the landlords. That sort of society they will not tolerate. Anybody who wants a restoration of that sort of thing is being cracked down on, yes.
We have many people who wish to ask questions of you, Professor, and we'll get to that in just one
Good.
Minute. My guest is Professor David Crook, who teaches languages at the University of Beiping. You teach anything but English?
I teach English.
You teach English?
Yes. My wife teaches Canadian.
She teaches Canadian. What's
well,
the difference?
Well, that's her brand. We have about a dozen English-speaking people on the staff, a couple of Americans, a New Zealander, a couple of Australians, one Canadian,
mm-hmm.
and a few English.
Well, now let's get to some of the people. Your name?
My name is David Head.
David Head. All right, Mr. Head.
Professor, this nation was founded by men and women who basically believe in God. Back in the history of the world, there were a great religious people that were kept in bondage in Egypt for 400 years. I'd like to ask you about the religious freedom of China today and whether or not there is the opportunity to worship God freely according to the dictates of one's conscience. Would you make a statement on that, sir?
Right, I'd be glad to. Now, actually, I met my wife in China, and she was born there. Her parents were Canadian missionaries there for 30 years. So I have some interest in this question, the same as you have. My parents-in-law came out to visit us for the first time in 1955 and stayed a few months in China. My mother-in-law is crippled and doesn't get around so much, but I accompanied my father-in-law to church, I think, pretty well every Sunday for 4 or 5 months. More recently, of course, my mother-in-law has been out to see us, and I took her to church, too. She doesn't get around too much, but we went on the Sunday before Christmas a couple of years ago. But, of course, Christianity is not religion in the broad sense of the term for the Chinese. The Chinese are traditionally Buddhists, Taoists, and so on. But I would say that the Chinese people have not been as, shall I say, fanatically religious as we often think of the Indian people as being. They've had a rather practical sort of approach. They've been concerned to placate the gods in order to get good crops. Nowadays they have the communes, and they are paying less attention to placating the gods and concentrating on other means. So I think it's a fair statement of the case would be the constitution of China guarantees freedom of religious worship, but that on the whole, religion is no longer retaining the old hold that it had on the people in the past, and perhaps in that respect it's rather like the situation in the United States. It certainly is the case in England. That if you go to church, for example, as I've done many times, the congregation is rather elderly, and there's not much of an appeal to the young people.
Professor, you were making a statement that you're free to go to church anytime you wish to, but that most of the people that go to church are the elderly. Right. What you're stating in essence, however, is exactly the situation in the Soviet Union and all over in the communist world. As I understand it, the constitution of both the Soviet Union and the Republic of China, as you call it, the People's Republic of China, guarantee freedom of religion.
Right.
But I have ample evidence to support the fact that there have been suppression of the churches, the closing of the church doors, and I happen to know many, many missionaries who've come back from there after the United States Christian people have invested 100 years of missionary activity in China, and that's gone down the drain.
Perfectly correct. The foreign missionaries have all returned from China, and Christianity in China, just what I was going to tell you. Christianity in China is standing on its own feet. It is a self-administering church run by the Chinese for the Chinese. My wife was born in a foreign mission community, and the situation there was that the missionaries lived in big houses, had plenty of servants, drew their salary in American currency. The Chinese Christian ministers and their colleagues lived on a very much lower standard, and they had less to say in the administration of the church and the funds. When the People's Government was set up in 1949, they made a point of it. There is freedom of worship, and the church should be run by the Chinese Christians, and that is the case today.
Do they have that freedom of worship in Tibet?
Yes.
I have before me an article written by the, and published from China, entitled China Pictorial.
Good.
And I'd just like to make one statement in conclusion. And I quote where it says the Tibetan people enjoy full religious freedom. And I talked to the brother of the Dalai Lama of Tibet for about 4 hours one afternoon, and I didn't get that picture from him.
I'd be glad to comment on that.
The reactionary clique of the upper social strata in Tibet have raised again and again the outcry of protecting religion. Yet they have persistently committed their criminal acts of destroying religion in league with imperialism and foreign reactionaries. They attacked the monastery, slaughtered the living Buddha, forced away the ninth Panchen Lama, and poisoned the patriotic living Buddha and the father of the 14th Dalai Lama. They murdered and insulted at will lamas and nuns, burned Buddhist scriptures, images, and dagobas, stole Buddhist relics and treasures, and used the monasteries as military strongholds. And then the last question.
Just a moment. Before you go on to another
one
question.
One final statement. Even abducted the Dalai Lama abroad. This reveals that they are a batch of ravenous beasts clad in religious attire. The Tibetan people enjoy no religious freedom today at all, and they've been taken over by the Chinese. And yet you say to me that there's open and free religious worship. They don't have it.
Now, I'd like to comment on your statement, and also I would like to make one thing clear, because the way you read that piece might have led people to suspect that all these acts against people in the church were perpetrated by the Tibetan people. If you present the thing as it should be, I'm not suggesting that you had any intention of distorting it, but I would like to make it clear that these actions were, of course, perpetrated by officials of the Tibetan church against members of that church. That is the purport of your statement, and I'd like to make that clear. Secondly, I would like to make this clear. I know that a great many people, perhaps including yourself, in this country and other parts of the West, are very much concerned about what they call free Tibet and Tibet's loss of freedom. But I would like to point out that 95% of the Tibetan people were either serfs or slaves. Now, they had no freedom to lose. Who has lost freedom in Tibet? The serf and slave owners have lost the freedom to own serfs and slaves.
What you're really saying is that China today, the China in which you live, is the savior of that part of the world. They've saved the Chinese people. Now they're moving ahead. They've saved the Tibetan people. Who else are they going to save from all of this serfdom that they seem to enjoy in their own freedom? Speaking of Tibet, and thank you very much. Yes, speaking of Tibet, I have here... And he doesn't mince words. I will pick a sentence out. I firmly believe that as long as the Chinese remain in occupation of Tibet, there will always be a threat to peace and progress of the countries in Asia and Southeast Asia.
Good.
I'd be
delighted to comment on that.
Must you?
Are you suggesting that in this program I'm the one to be deprived of freedom of speech?
Certainly not, but
well, then
would
let
you
me
say
comment.
Something would
I
you
shall.
Say something that we
I shall
going to
say
surprise
something
us.
As soon as you let me.
All right, say
now,
it.
Naturally the Dalai Lama protests. The Dalai Lama belonged to the 5% of the serf and slave owners. He's been deprived of his freedom to own serfs and slaves, and he protests. Well, if you wish to uphold serfdom and slavery, you have the right to do so. I personally am opposed to it.
It's not quite that easy, Professor. What you're really saying is that if the Chinese communists go into a country and absolutely strangle it like a boa constrictor, that they're doing this for these poor, poor serfs. Any other country doing it, and you'd yell imperialism, wouldn't you?
All right, I'll comment on that. It may interest you to know, that is if you are interested to learn something about China, that Tibet has been a part of China since long before the Mayflower reached these shores, and even since before Wales became part of the United Kingdom.
Have you informed the Tibetans of this?
The Tibetans need no such information. The Dalai Lama may. But when the serf and slave owners staged a rebellion in 1959, it was very quickly quelled, in spite of the fact that there was an extremely small force of the Central Army in Tibet. It was quelled because the Tibetan people sided with the army against the serf and slave owners. So if you're suggesting that somebody has been deprived of freedom, now you know who it is.
Certainly do. It's the Tibetans, thanks to Mao and that bunch of red Chinese communists. What is your name?
I'm John Sainsbury from the Young Americans for Freedom. I was very interested in what Professor Crook had to say, although I think it's more of a compliment to call him a professor. A professor is usually one who teaches, and I don't feel like referring to him further in this discourse as a professor. I think
you may call him Mr. Crook.
Yes.
Get on with what you're going to say.
That's really what I would prefer.
Fine.
I'm even
okay,
extending myself calling him Mr. He said in the beginning that he's on the side of new China, and in case it wasn't clear, i.e. red China, and that they don't have any trouble picking up freezing corpses anymore. They're much more efficient. They have, I'm sure, their own police force takes care of them at night. The bit about the Tibetans is very interesting, how you can on one hand reject with the Maoist philosophy the old when it's inconvenient, but yet when it's convenient for your purpose, you call back to it. You say, well, this was always known in the old tradition of China that Tibet was always part of China.
This
in the old tradition of China, the whole world was part of it,
States
and you owed allegiance to the emperor.
The United States government in 1943 made perfectly clear that it acknowledged that Tibet was part of China. I'm not going back to Confucius.
You see, Mr. Crook...
I'm demoted, all right.
You're, You're very difficult to argue with because you don't bother with the basic decencies of truth. Something similar, somebody in Europe who said, if you make the lie big enough, people might believe you, you know. And tonight, that's just about what you've done. The people in China have plenty to eat, but yet they must import millions of dollars worth of wheat from Canada. And
would you like me to comment on that question of wheat?
Not really, but go ahead.
All right, I will. The Chinese are buying wheat from Canada. Perfectly true. Does that mean that Chinese agriculture is in a mess? Certainly not. They're getting it at a good price. It enables them to export rice and soybeans, for which they get a higher price on the world market. The more wheat they import, the more hard currency they make.
I presume you have statistics on that, too.
They can use that on buying machinery to speed up their industrialization. It's good business.
The big flop forward, you mean?
It's good business.
All right, thank you very much. Young lady.
Mr. Burke, Professor, my name is Mrs. Catherine Bregman, and I'd like to know how old you were when you made your decision to go teach in communist China, and exactly what prompted you to make this decision.
Well, now, look at my bald head. I'm 56. That was in 1938. How old was I then? You work it out. 28? Something like that. I went to teach in mission universities in China. I did teach in them for 3 years. I don't know that I would have necessarily stayed on quite as long as I have done if it hadn't been that I happened to meet my wife out there then. She was born and brought up there. Well, spent part of her education there, most of it in Canada. And we both have an abiding interest in China. It's a fascinating country. Marco Polo found that out, and so have a lot of people since. And does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Did this particular interest that you now have in communist China start there? I mean, this obvious interest that you have in helping the underdog, as I suppose you would call them the underdog.
No, you call them the underdog.
Yeah, well, when did it really start?
Well, it started some little time before I went out there, I suppose.
Didn't you fight in the...
I didn't keep a diary of it.
Yes, weren't you a participant in the Spanish Civil War on the communist side?
I was.
On the communist side in the Spanish Civil War.
On the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah, well, call it what you like. Think about that while we give you a message or two, right here. Discussing communist China with a man who knows because he spent 20 years there. Your name, young lady?
My name is Darlene Costello, and while I'm not an expert on world economics, I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Crook. When Mr. Burke was talking to you during a conversation about the availability of certain products in China, your answer seemed very evasive to me. Now, when he asked you, for instance, how much soap, you said, well, it's enough. But now, what is enough soap for them? Do they use soap like I would use soap whenever I want to clean my hands? But do they realize how much soap they have, and this way they ration how much of a portion, how much soap they can't wash their hands as much as I can because evidently they can't afford it while we can. But you didn't bring this out, and I don't understand. Is this true, or do they have as much soap as I do? Can they afford the same things I can?
Well, just before I answer you, I must make one comment on the closing remarks of Mr. Berg here, who repeated that I had been on the communist side in Spain two or three times. This, of course, is the old McCarthyite smear tactics, which is intended to undermine my credibility. I would just like to draw attention to this. Now I'll answer your question. Now, actually, I'm sorry if I appear evasive, but after all, if I were to ask you how many cakes of soap the people in America use a month, would you know? Perhaps the market research people on the commercials would know. Frankly, I don't. All I know is that the Chinese people have enough soap to keep themselves clean. Whether they use as much as you do, I honestly don't know. But they certainly use more than they've ever used in the past in China.
No, but my question again, you're still being evasive to me even. I don't realize
Sorry.
That this is purposely. Do they feel free to use it whenever they want you to? Any
certainly
material for
do.
That instance. They can
do.
Use it whenever
yes,
they want
certainly.
To. In other words, there is no economic problem there, that they have this available.
Oh, I wouldn't say there's no economic problem in China. I wouldn't say there's no
with
economic problem in America.
Young lady, we're going round and round with the cake of soap. I'm going to answer your question for you rather pointedly.